You ever look around at life and think, this can't be it, right? Like you're sitting in traffic behind a car with a live, laugh, love bumper sticker. Well, the news app on your phone is screaming about collapsing ecosystems and microplastics in your spleen. And you just sort of short circuit. Because deep down, even if you pretend you're above it all, you've been waiting for something to make all this make sense. It's like some big cinematic reveal. The part where Morgan Freeman shows up and says, "Here's the reason for everything. Sorry for the wait." But of course, that moment never comes. Okay, so let's get one thing out of the way. You, me, and everyone we've ever known is going to die. And I don't mean that to be morbid. It's just natural scheduling. We're all on a one-way conveyor belt headed straight to oblivion. And the only real suspense is whether it's cancer, heart disease, or maybe a situation where it's some guy in a lifted pickup truck with road rage and a vape pen. And the cherry on top is that in a few billion years, the sun will balloon into a red giant and casually incinerate this whole planet like it's throwing away leftovers. No eulogies or funeral procession, just cosmic house cleaning. So, if you've ever wondered whether your meticulously curated LinkedIn profile or your emotionally unavailable X really matter? No, they don't really. Not cosmically, and not in a way the universe notices or cares about. And interestingly, I don't find that depressing. I find it relieving. Because it means that the pressure's off. We don't need to impress the void. This is where absurdism lives. That tiny little pocket between despair and freedom, where everything is pointless. And that's exactly why I think it's beautiful. So Albert Camus, the guy who more or less gave absurdism a name, he didn't flinch when he looked at this mess. He stared right into the meaningless machinery of the universe and he said, "Okay, now pass the cigarettes." He wasn't suicidal or hopeless. He was just tired of pretending that the universe owed us a reason. And that, my friends, is where the fun begins. Okay, so Albert Camus wasn't your typical philosopher. He didn't hide behind jargon or spend his life in a library surrounded by dead languages. He was poor, Algerian, grew up under colonial rule, lost his father before he could walk, lived with a mother who was deaf and barely spoke. He was a goalie and he loved soccer. He chain smoked and he got laid. It was what I would say painfully human and painfully aware of how absurd everything was. So by the time World War II rolled around, he was writing editorials for the Resistance. He literally fought fascists while pondering whether existence had any real meaning. That's kind of like running into a burning building while contemplating that the heat death of the universe. Now, Camus didn't write from an ivory tower. He wrote from the street or the cafe, the battlefield, and even the morgue. And that's why I think his ideas still punch today. So Camus saw people around him desperate for structure. Religion, politics, nationalism, whatever could give life a plot. They wanted the universe to behave like a good story. And they wanted purpose, justice, order, and happy endings. But reality kept spitting out chaos, as it does. Children died, good people were crushed, and bad people got rich. Plagues hit, empires fell, friends disappeared. Meaningless, brutal things kept happening for no reason. And instead of running away from that, or pretending none of it existed, Camus leaned into all this. He said, "Here we are, sentient apes screaming into an indifferent void, demanding that it hug us back. And the void doesn't answer. It never has, and it never will." And that silence, that's what he called the absurd. Alrighty then. So absurdism isn't just life is weird. It's the fiction you feel between your desperate need for clarity and the universe's cold refusal to provide it. It's sort of like being trapped in an escape room with no clues or exits, and a game master who doesn't speak your language, and then finding out the room is actually your life. I know it sounds kind of like a Black Mirror episode or something. You know, we want life to be like a novel, like some kind of hero's journey or something. Something with arcs and themes and a catharsis. But reality is more like improv performed by raccoons on acid. Camus looked at that disconnect and said, "Don't pretend it's not there. Don't sugarcoat it, and don't baptize it in some religion or ideology or moral system. Don't gaslight yourself into thinking you'll get answers if you just meditate hard enough or buy the right crystals. Just sit in it. Let it be absurd, and then choose how you want to live anyway." Probably easier said than done, but I 100% believe it's worth it if you can pull it off. So that choice to live without illusion, to live with the absurd instead of always fighting it, is what sets Camus apart. He wasn't interested in suicide, literal or philosophical. He also hated false comforts. He thought that throwing yourself into religion or ideology to escape life's uncertainty was just another way to tap out. He called it philosophical suicide, trading one lie for another just to get some sleep at night. But what if you don't need lies? What if you can live honestly with the chaos? That's the real rebellion. Not blowing something up or joining a movement. Just waking up every day and choosing to show up no matter what. And knowing it isn't going to be fair or make sense and no one's actually keeping score. That, according to Camus, is where you start being truly free. Okay, so let's talk about a guy named Sisyphus. You've probably heard this story from Philosophy 101, Greek myths. The gods decided Sisyphus was too clever for his own good. So they sentenced him to push a massive boulder up a hill over and over again forever. And every time he gets close to the top, the damn thing rolls back down. Rinse, repeat, eternally. It sounds kind of like torture, right? Like a metaphor for working a soul-crushing job or doing your taxes while slowly dying inside. But Camus looked at this myth and instead of shaking his head, he saw something profound, something strangely liberating about it. So he wrote this little book called The Myth of Sisyphus. Basically, it's a philosophical love letter to the guy doomed to push a rock forever. And Camus imagines Sisyphus standing there at the bottom of the hill again, watching the boulder roll back down. And instead of despairing, he smiles and shrugs. Maybe he lights a cigarette, and then he walks back up and he starts all over again. Now, he's not doing this because he's hoping things will change or because he's been promised some reward, but because this absurd repetition is his life and he owns it. He comes to terms with it. That's really the heart of absurdism right there. Not giving up and not deluding yourself. Just saying, all right, this is my situation. I'm going to show up for it anyway. I think to some degree we're all Sisyphus. I think it's just written into the human condition, whether we like it or not. And we wake up and go to work. We fall in love. We get hurt. Maybe we make some art. We clean the house. We get sick. Then we get better. Then we get sick again. We pay bills. Write emails, wait in line at the DMV, and, you know, all the while, the rock keeps rolling. But once you stop expecting the boulder to stay at the top, you start paying more attention to the climb itself. The air, the view, the strength in your legs. You notice that the absurd repetition is kind of beautiful if you stop trying to escape from it. So that's what Camus meant when he said one must imagine Sisyphus happy. Not blissful or high and false hope, just present and grounded, aware and alive. The struggle itself, Camus says, is enough to fill a person's heart. Now, this is where some people get confused. They hear all of this and they think Camus was promoting passivity. Like, okay, nothing matters, so I'll just sit here and rot. But that's not what rebellion means in the absurdist sense. Camus made a big deal out of drawing a line between revolution and rebellion. Revolution is more about replacing one set of dogmas with another. Kill the king and crown a new one. You know, burn the system, build another system. And maybe that works for a while until the new system starts demanding blind loyalty again. But rebellion, real rebellion is quieter. It's daily and internal. It's the decision to live with open eyes and to create meaning in a world that refuses to give it to you. Real rebellion is about making things anyway and loving anyway. And to keep going even when we know how it ends. You know, I don't think we rebel against absurdity by denying it. We rebel by embracing it and refusing to let it dictate how much heart we bring to the moment. So, absurd rebellion is working a dead-end job and still giving a damn. It's getting ghosted and choosing to stay vulnerable. And it's also reading poetry to a cat who couldn't care less. Or fighting for justice, even if the system's stacked and rigged and rotting from the inside out. You know, you're not doing it because you think it's going to fix everything. You're doing it because this is your moment. And you're not handing it over to despair, dogma, or to TikTok therapy influencers who talk about alignment while selling water bottles full of moonlight. So Camus didn't want you to throw your life away or escape into fantasies. He wanted you to rebel by living as if your choices matter because you say they do. Now, of course, this kind of raw honesty about life is difficult. I'd guess that most people want off this ride the second it stops being fun. And I don't blame them. And Camus saw three main ways people try to escape the absurd. First, the nuclear option, actual suicide. Camus opens the myth of Sisyphus by calling it the only serious philosophical question. Because if life is meaningless, why keep going? But he didn't view suicide as a solution. He saw it as a, he saw it as giving up before you've even played your hand, like leaving the movie halfway through because you realized it doesn't have a happy ending. And, you know, maybe it doesn't, but what if the point isn't the ending at all? Then there's what he called philosophical suicide. That's when you decide to believe in something absolute just to kill the discomfort. Religion, nationalism, you know, some grand ideology that pretends to have all the answers in a neat little pamphlet. Now, if we genuinely believe something because we've wrestled with it, great. But if we're just propping up a story because we can't stomach ambiguity, that's not really faith. That's just fear in a costume. And the third escape hatch, distraction. And we've got plenty of that these days. So Camus didn't have TikTok, but if he did, he'd probably call it a cathedral of avoidance. You know, filling every single moment with noise so you don't ever have to sit in the quiet and ask yourself, what the hell am I actually doing here? And none of these escapes makes the absurd go away. They just kind of numb it. But the absurd doesn't need to be numbed. It just needs to be faced. Because on the other side of that confrontation is something wild and weird and liberating. All right. Now, Camus might have been the poster boy for absurdism, but he wasn't exactly a solo act. There's a whole parade of weirdos and poets and sad geniuses marching down the same existential alleyway. So let's take a quick tour. First stop, Franz Kafka. Now, Kafka was the guy you'd invite to your dinner party if you wanted everyone to go home questioning their identity, their job, whether their dad ever actually loved them, and frankly, their very lives. He gave us stories like The Metamorphosis, where a guy named Gregor wakes up as a giant insect and nobody really bats an eye or even asks why. They just kind of go, oh, Gregor can't work anymore. Guess we'll lock him in his room. That's it. No moral, no closure, just existential dread with a crunchy exoskeleton. So Kafka's whole deal was this: institutions are broken. Logic doesn't really matter. And you can scream all you want, but nobody's coming to explain the plot, and nobody's really coming to save you. It was like the original customer service rep for the absurd. You have questions? I understand. But no, we will not be providing any answers. Now have an A1 day. Okay. Then there's Samuel Beckett, the playwright equivalent of a slow motion existential car crash. His most famous work, Waiting for Godot, is literally about two guys waiting for someone who never shows up. That's pretty much the whole play. And they just keep talking about nothing and everything, about carrots and boots. It's bleak, hilarious, but nonetheless weirdly touching. Kind of like overhearing two drunk philosophers stuck in purgatory. So Beckett wasn't trying to depress you. He was trying to get you to notice how funny it is when people cling to hope in a world that doesn't deliver. You know, the joke is that there's no punchline. The punchline is that you're still here waiting. Now, let's toss in Kierkegaard, the anxious Dane who kind of set the stage for all this. So he talked a lot about dread and faith and how freedom makes people want to vomit. Now, Kierkegaard was the guy who looked at the abyss. It felt a little dizzy and said, "You know what? I'm going to jump, but I'm going to call it God." Camus, on the other hand, he looked into the same abyss and he went, "Nah, I'll just build a weird little shack next to it and write essays." Okay, then we've got Jean-Paul Sartre and the existentialists. Now, they believed you could create your own meaning through action. Choose your own essence, or choose your own adventure, I guess. And live authentically. You know, all that jazz. And Camus was like, "Great idea, guys. But don't start pretending that those choices mean anything to the universe. That's a trap. It's like arguing over how to decorate your apartment while ignoring that the whole building's on fire." And of course, there's Kurt Vonnegut, the literary prankster who gave us aliens and time travel and war trauma, and phrases like, "So it goes," every time someone dies. Now, Vonnegut knew the absurd wasn't just academic, it was basically everyday life. The war, bureaucracy, all the bullshit, and everything else. His books were elegies for the broken, sung in fart jokes and cynicism. But there was a real, well, there was a weird kindness in it too. Like he was winking at you from across the void. So if Camus handed you a cigarette and told you to be brave, Vonnegut handed you a whiskey and he said, "Laugh at it, kid. It's all garbage anyway." Okay, so how do we live absurdly now in the year of our Lord, late stage corporate capitalism? How do we push our boulder when it's connected to a Fitbit? And how the hell do we find freedom when the calendar has 17 color-coded events and the phone keeps buzzing about a cat meme and a possible missile strike? Absurdism in modern life isn't just philosophical, it's also physical. It's in your bones when you show up to a job that's slowly killing you so you can afford overpriced groceries and a mattress that remembers your sleep position. It's in your inbox and your endless scroll, and it's in the ache behind your eyes when you realize you've been watching other people's highlight reels for so long. You forgot what your own feels like. So here's where absurdism still matters. It says we're not obligated to pretend any of this makes sense. And we don't have to buy into the myth that our value is measured in productivity or followers. We can sit with the absurdity of it all and still choose to create something, or I don't know, plant a tree, or maybe tell someone you love them, even though nothing really lasts. We can enjoy our lunch even if the planet is dying and laugh at the absurdity of democracy being decided by people who think birds aren't real. And we can wake up and look at the world and say, yeah, this is a fucking mess, but it's my mess. Because I think once you stop trying to fix the world in some grand, impossible way, you can start fixing the little things, the real things. Such as showing up for people, creating something nobody asked for, calling your weird uncle, petting your dog like it's the first and last time you'll ever touch fur. I think we stop needing the universe to approve our existence and we just start existing and being okay with that. And that's more than enough. All right, so let's be clear. Joy, rebellion, and the art of giving a damn. Absurdism doesn't say nothing matters and then leave you crying into your cereal. It says nothing matters, so you get to choose what does. And the key difference is that we're not trapped in the absurd, we're aware of it. Now, most people sleepwalk through life hunting for external validation, hoping someone somewhere will hand them some tidy little answer and a gold star. But deep down, we know the answers aren't coming. We've seen behind the curtain, and it's just more curtain. And instead of panicking or numbing out or joining a cult that makes us wear linen and pretend mushroom coffee is a spiritual experience, we choose to stay awake. We keep showing up. We love people even though they're flawed and weird and sometimes ghost us. We keep making art even if the only person who sees it is your mom and a bored algorithm. And we laugh, not because life's a joke, but because the only other option is screaming into a pillow. And let's face it, laughter is way less annoying at parties. So that's the rebellion Camus talked about. Not some loud performative rage against the system or marching in circles demanding to be noticed by an indifferent universe that's busy spinning galaxies. It's quieter than that. And I think it's more stubborn. It's you standing in the wreckage, sweeping up the pieces, and planting a garden in the ashes. So it's not really optimism, but it's not nihilism. It's what I'd call functional defiance, which is to say, we're not pretending life is meaningful or meaningless either. We're just saying, All right, if I'm stuck in this absurd play, I'm going to at least write my own damn lines. And I think that's what makes a progenitor of the absurd so dangerous. They can't be bought or guilt-tripped. They can't be scared into playing along with a story they know is made up, they love fully, and create contentedly without the expectation of validation. I think embracing the absurd is to live honestly without the hope of being rewarded. It's the only rebellion that actually makes life feel like living. Okay, so Camus, he didn't hand us a manifesto. He gave us a mirror. He said, look, this is life. It's irrational and unjust and it's chaotic and it ends. Yet, here we are. We can curse the void or we can smile at it. We can demand meaning or we can make meaning. I think the absurd hero isn't immune to pain or despair. They just refuse to outsource their meaning to someone else's system. And they try to live like each moment matters, not in some eternal sense, but because it's theirs. I mean, do we really need a cosmic mission to get out of bed in the morning? Is it imperative that the universe clap for us every time we care about something? I don't think our lives have to echo through time. It just has to feel real while we're in it. So, yeah, maybe nothing really matters, but that kindness you showed today to somebody probably mattered. And that terrible art made one person laugh on a shitty Tuesday. Maybe that mattered. The time you helped a stranger, not because of karma, points, or God's scoreboard, but because you could, that was rebellion. It was meaning. Born from the absurd. Okay, so now what? Well, you wake up tomorrow and make coffee, feed the pets, check your phone, and get a little sad because the world's still falling apart. And then you push the boulder. You push the boulder because it's yours. And you don't do it for applause or for a purpose. You do it because being alive means moving something uphill with your bare hands while the universe observes in perfect silence. And every now and then, maybe you even smile, but just a little. Because that boulder, doesn't really own you. You choose to push it. And that choice, that defiance, that's yours. And that, my friends, might be the most meaningful, meaningless thing you'll ever do. So Camus wrote, "The struggle itself towards the heights is enough. To fill a man's heart, one must imagine Sisyphus happy." Yeah, we're imagining him. And some days we're even imagining ourselves. All right, well, now if you'll excuse me, I have a hill to climb and a boulder with my name on it. Thanks for watching.